news, information, opinions, history, and most importantly, always real. This is Rant EM Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Lex Podcast, episode 21, Married Movie Reviews, part 11. My name's Lex.
And I'm Latasha.
And we have four films for you tonight that we will be reviewing. And it's interesting because for me, it's going to be my least favorite film of the year and my favorite film of the year thus far. So you'll get the whole spectrum here tonight. And we're going to cut right to it because, you know, we've got so many films to review tonight. So they just kind of threw a bunch of films into our theater, and I guess it's rapid pace time before the holiday movies come out, and they stay 3-4 weeks in the theater before they go out. So we're going to start with you. You have the
Indeed.
First review.
Is this a first, or?
I don't think so, is it?
Maybe not. Maybe we just don't usually jump right in, so it feels like it's that I'm not first.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, so Dolphin Tale 2. A few years after the events in Dolphin Tale, the rescued dolphin Winter loses her surrogate mother, Panama, to old age. Her team of caretakers must try to find another female dolphin to pair her with so that Winter can stay at the Clearwater Marine Aquarium and Hospital. A cast consists of returning actors Morgan Freeman, Ashley Judd, Nathan Gamble, and Harry Connick Jr., which lend familiarity to the screen for anyone who saw the first film, but the acting and storyline aren't anything spectacular. I give this a 3 out of 5, and I feel like maybe that's slightly generous.
I give it a 3 out of 5, too, and I think that is generous in the sense of I was looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, who's going to go see this film? It's going to be probably whole families with young children, you know, straight-laced families, etc. And I think it does do its job in that sense. I think it's mildly.
And we haven't seen the first one, so we have no idea if this is like a good continuation of the first one. So I think that that's, you know, another big crowd is those who went and saw the first one or kind of what their target audience was. But my biggest issue with this movie is that the trailer is so deceiving about what the story is. You know, the whole thing with this trailer is that Winter must be paired with another dolphin. Somebody from the USDA is giving 30 days for them to correct the problem. And then the next bit in the trailer is they found a dolphin and it's a female. So let's get her and let's pair them together.
Right,
and so
exactly.
It makes it seem like the whole film is like about this event and then pairing them together. But literally it takes place in the last like 15, 20 minutes of the film.
Well, I think the trailer doesn't.
Of the nearly 2-hour film, mind you.
I think the trailer doesn't reveal the true tension behind everything. Basically, they run a hospital / recovery center for...
Yeah, it's like a rehab center for marine animals.
Marine animals. There you go. And it's become a museum of sorts, you know, an aquarium.
These animals come in, they rehab them,
right.
They live in the aquarium, the people come visit, and once they're rehabilitated, they're released back out into the
wild. Right, exactly. So people pay money to get a ticket to look at these animals and so on.
And
Winter
some,
is the main draw.
Yeah, because there are some animals that even with the rehabilitation, they cannot be released to the wild, Winter being one of them because she has lost her tail, so she has the prosthetic tail.
So basically, they do these shows with Winter where it's like a swimming show, and that's the biggest draw of everything. So when this other dolphin dies, she gets in a mood, and she, being the dolphin, and doesn't want to, doesn't want to swim, actually smacks the kid she swims with in the face with her beak, and kind of just goes underneath her platform and just stays there. So the true tension is that the person funding this whole operation is counting on Winter to bring in profits so they can continue running this. And basically, if they can't get another dolphin with Winter, they're going to move Winter to another place somewhere.
So in, like, Texas. This takes place in Florida.
Exactly.
So they're going to literally lose her completely.
Yeah. So the whole tension of the film is trying to find that other dolphin. Or, you know, then everything could go south. And so that's what I think the trailer left out. And that's the reason why it didn't seem like it was the same film, is because, yes, all that happens at the end, but there's a reason it all happens at the end, just to build up that anticipation of, are they going to find a dolphin?
But at the same time, I just feel like, because literally the whole movie, I'm like, when does this little dolphin Hope that we meet in the trailer come into the picture?
So I dolphins just, are mean.
Yeah. So it just seemed weird that, like, you know, and I know that the whole point of a trailer is to, is the hook. It's supposed to catch you, reel you in, then you go see the film. So there are some trailers that, you know, show all the funny
you
parts
can only
of the
show
movie's
so
dull.
Much,
there's some trailers that, you know, piece together and make a film seem way different than it is or whatever. And it's not that that happened in this situation. I just feel like the trailer sort of manipulated me into believing it was going to be, you know, this different story than it was.
Yeah. I think this, but I, like I said, I think it does achieve what it sets out to achieve, in the sense of it's being kind towards animals. It's the, you know, getting across that good message in the wake of all this SeaWorld controversy and stuff like that.
What controversy?
There's a documentary release called Blackfish about SeaWorld mistreating the animals. Yeah. Mm. So basically there's a big old thing about it now.
Well, there you go, folks. Watch it. Become enlightened like I am not.
But anyway, I mean, this is, you know, kind. It's like we're, us as humans, we're the bad ones. They're the wild animals. They don't understand. We have to have patience for them. And so on and so forth. But that's just it. There's like nothing much else to that. So the whole film is riding on whether or not they can find another dolphin. And they actually do find a different dolphin. Mandy.
Yeah, early in the film, Mandy is found beached. She has some sort of like respiratory issue and like a wicked sunburn.
Yeah. That was the coolest stuff, is actually seeing them in action, healing the dolphin.
Yeah.
You know, seeing them put sunscreen on the burn and all that stuff as our cats are going absolutely nuts in the house.
at least they're not doing it at 2 a.m.
Yeah, I guess so. but, you know, seeing them in action, seeing them rescue the dolphin and all that stuff, that was cool.
They also
to see.
Show a turtle rescue.
Yeah. And that bird.
Freaking pelican.
Rufus. There's a pelican that follows everyone around pretty much, and he gets their attention, brings them down to a dock, and there's like a turtle stuck with some plastic or something.
And he has like a fishing net wrapped around him or something like that. So they take him back to the hospital, they remove everything, they, you know, stick him in a little swimming pool till he's healed, and then they
So they do show rescues of other animals besides dolphins. It's not just dolphins, it's not just dolphins that they have there. But obviously, Winter without the tail, that's the big attraction, so that's what everyone's focused on. And then there's this other subplot where the kid, the main kid who was in the first one, has an opportunity to go sailing in the Atlantic waters, I believe.
Yeah, and basically it's like this, it's called Sea Semester, so it's like a college that does marine biology stuff is offering him a scholarship to spend a semester on board the ship and having hands-on educational experience. So he's not only going to get this hands-on experience, but he's also going to get college credits and full credits for his high school bits that he's missing. And it's like he's torn between wanting to do it because it's such an amazing opportunity, but not wanting to leave Winter behind, especially with the unknown of if she's going to stay or if they're going to lose her. So he's, you know, got this personal conflict happening.
Right, which also seemed really silly to me because it's... I mean, I get that he has emotional attachment to it because of the first film, but it's also... it's a dolphin, you know? It's...
but it's just like some people, their pets are their babies.
Yeah,
and he, again, having not seen the first one, but he obviously is like the one who is her main caretaker because he you know, he comments multiple times, I know Winter better than anyone.
As soon as that dolphin bitch slapped me, I'd be out to sea. I'd be sailing the Atlantic saying, forget that dolphin. Have fun in Texas. But there's actually quite a few people on the cast. Morgan Freeman, Ashley Judd. Harry Connick Jr. is the male grown-up lead. Chris Christopherson. You know, so there's a few people on here that... and actually, Bethany Hamilton, which is a surfer...
yeah, who lost her arm.
To a shark attack.
Yeah, so she makes an appearance about how Winter is an inspiration to her. And, you know, I feel like that was, like, shameless and cheesy, but whatever.
What it suffers from is the same thing. And this is same people who did The Blind Side, who did When the Game Stands Tall, you know, who did whatever. The cheesy score... the, you know, over-sentimental value of the film.
Right.
You know, it borderlines on that. But it's, at the same time, it's a nice film to go take your family to. And, of course, me is just a moviegoer, critic, viewer, whatever you want to say. The scenes with the dolphins were drawn out way too long underwater. Because they did these swimming things. And it looks cool. And the camera work underwater is cool and...
yeah, there were some cool shots with it, but did we really need 7 minutes of, you know, this little show?
Right, we got
did
the,
we really
we get
need,
the gist of things.
You know, an extended view of it.
Yeah.
Not really, but it's what we got. So, it's not, you know, it's...
I recommend it. If you got a family, I recommend it. If you don't have a family... you
save
know,
your money.
Yeah, it's probably not going to be for you. It's very limited value, entertainment value. It's not a bad film, it's just not...
I would guess, though, that if you saw and liked the first one, you'll enjoy this. Again, I haven't seen the first one, so I can't compare them as films.
Yeah, if you saw the first one, there's no real reason to not enjoy this film. It's pretty much the same thing, I'm guessing. So it's decent performances. Nobody's going out of their way to try to win any awards for this film, but it's fine. I gave it a 3.5. You gave it a 3.5. So
I gave it a 3.
Or excuse me, I gave it a 3 as well. So
okay.
Two threes.
two threes.
Yeah.
Three.
It's not bad, not great. So.
Yeah, right there in the middle.
It's a rare occasion to see a film that you know will stand the test of time. A film that actually says something about something important. Such as Boyhood, critically acclaimed filmmaker Richard Linklater's grand masterpiece of growing up, shot over 12 years with every role being played by the same actor over that time. First, there's the gimmick of filming over such a long period of time. 12 years is long, even for a documentary, let alone a three-hour theatrical film. It's all very impressive, but the real thing to marvel about is how the gimmick reinforces the story. Without this approach, Boyhood is simply a good film, not a great film. But the emotional connection I made with the Evans family, literally watching them grow up before my eyes, is just as effective as a documentary. All faults and downsides of the film become irrelevant when you realize what the film is doing and saying. What it's doing is showing us not only the big events that shape who we become, but the small events that shape our personalities. By this effect, there's not a single second of wasted screen time in the film. What it's saying is that you don't have to become famous or rich to be happy later in life, regardless of the pressures parents and/or teachers put on children to live up to ridiculous expectations. But most importantly, Boyhood, as a film, shows us that you can't force a meaningful existence. It takes time and self-exploration. Both Mason Jr. as a character in the film and Richard Linklater to make the film prove this. It's okay to be normal, average, mediocre, as long as you're pleasing your own master and not someone else's. Boyhood gets a 5 out of 5 from me.
Which is your first 5
first
out of 5.
First perfect score. And we've discussed this over and over again on the podcast. What would make you bump it up to a 5? And I point to this to say, it's not a perfect film. But it
that's
is.
That's what makes it perfect.
It is a perfect film because it transcends film. It's like a great novel that, you know, gets read over and over in school.
Right.
Because it says something. It's not just there for entertainment purposes like a Transformers, which is fine in its own right, you know. It's it is what it is. Great visuals, stimulating action scenes, but dumb when it comes to casting and story. This was fantastic because what he managed to do is take what you would see in a documentary and put it into a film so that, and people say, well, this scene didn't go anywhere and this didn't do anything, but it does.
It
absolutely
does.
Yeah. Because it sets the serious real life tone of the film. In our everyday life, not every single moment is a big moment.
And that's what I personally loved about this. And I even commented to you, I liked that the dialogue was realistic and that the interactions between the children, you know, as younger kids with their dad, I just feel like it was realistic. Like you could really overhear that conversation in, you know, a bowling alley. You could really, you know, see them playing football on the side of a hill. Like it all felt real. None of it felt fake or forced.
That's the thing. I've heard criticisms of, well, that scene with the kids, that dialogue was awful. They're kids. It's what you would hear kids that age say. It's not, and people have a real problem with being conditioned to someone writing on a script or writing on a page what everyone says. I guarantee you not all of this was written down on page. It was improvised and, you know, he said, just be yourself.
You know,
or
get the gist of this topic.
Right, exactly.
And that's good enough.
Yeah, so not every single scene has award-winning dialogue in it, but that's the point. It's not supposed to. It's supposed to feel like you're just, you know, you're a fly on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And this, even if it's not pretty, even if the language is bad, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens in life, and I don't think people can grasp the concept of that sometimes, what actually does occur out there, because they're not there, they're not in the thick of things, they don't understand. Mm-hmm. If you grew up with one of these situations that happens in the film, it's probably going to hit you harder emotionally.
Right.
But even if you don't, it's good to see, as long as you can understand that this does happen out there, it's good to see what else happens out there. Not every single thing in this film happened to me, or hardly any of it happened to me, but I could still connect with them because I've lived long enough to know what real life looks like and what movie life looks like. And they did a tremendous job of blurring the lines here, even though this isn't a movie.
There were situations in this that I could relate to with growing up and everything, with, you know, having parents who were divorced and dating other people, married to other people,
right,
you know, what have you. So I was able to actually connect to that a lot. And it was me and my brother. I was the oldest child and had a younger brother.
Right.
And that's how it is in the story, him and his older sister. So a lot of it was incredibly relatable to me personally. But just the storyline aside, just the fact that they did this over a 12-year period.
Right.
You know, they could have easily taken some concept and done this actor plays him at this age, this actor plays him at that age,
right,
and then now we've got this person as an adult playing the adult version. They could have done that easily if it was just the purpose of making a film and telling a story. But he wanted to actually share life. And I feel that was just like
it was
the most brilliant
risk.
Move. Huge risk, definitely, because, you know, something could have happened to somebody over the course of that 12 years to where they couldn't continue.
Nobody was under contract because they couldn't sign someone to that long of a contract.
Yeah.
It's illegal to do that. And,
So hoping that these people are going to make commitments, because also the two main people who play the parents are they're not huge names, but they're big name people. You got Ethan Hawke right. playing the father and Patricia Arquette as the mother. Those are, you know, pretty decently known actors who have done, you know, lots of other film or she's in TV and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I was interested in how all of this was done, so I did look things up, and, you know, basically they'd get together for about a week once a year over the course of this time, and they'd film. And, you know, in total, they only spent 45 days over the course of this 12 years actually filming, and, you know, they didn't worry about things being perfect because they wanted the realism there, and I just feel like they nailed it, you know, hit the nail on the head with that. And
yeah, I mean, something could have happened to the actors, something could have happened to the director, which in that case, I heard Ethan Hawke would be the one to continue it on. If Linklater passed away or something happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the film could have been, you know, destroyed somehow, you know?
Right.
Just all this work to, all this gamble to just kind of let it ride on one concept of, this is going to make this film that much better because mm-hmm. of this. Otherwise, it's maybe at best a good film. You know, in a lot of people I saw saying this doesn't even deserve so much as a 5 out of 10, which is absolutely insane to me, but coming from their perspective, if they don't see what they are trying to go for in this film and succeed in going for,
mm-hmm.
then it just looks like a normal film that's about nothing. Like,
yeah.
It's like Seinfeld. So many people are like, it's a show about nothing. That's the point.
Right.
The point is there is no point. This is life. This is,
and not everybody has like this grand master plan for their life, and you know that's
right.
what, like in the movie or the show Revenge, like there's a very definitive plot line with that. Not everybody's life is like that particular life,
right?
So not everything is going to be that straight to the point.
Before we go on, let's explain the plot a little more. So there's this single mother of two. Patricia Arquette, her son is Mason Jr., who is the star of the film,
mm-hmm.
Ella Coltrane, and then there's his sister, Samantha, who's played by Lorelai Linklater, so that's the director's daughter, which is actually pretty smart to get your own daughter to play this, because
he didn't want her to, but she basically said, you have to let me or else.
Right, but she also wanted to quit during the process, and he's like, you can't do that.
Yeah, you kind of have to keep going.
Right, so I mean, it's kind of nice to have your daughter in there.
Yeah.
And then their father, estranged father, is played by Ethan Hawke. So in the beginning of the film, you see them, he's 6 years old, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Samantha's a little bit older than him. 2 years, I think.
Yeah, I think that the implication is she's about 2 years older.
Yeah. So you see him kind of just laying on the grass and looking at the sky, and that sets up the blank slate.
And that's the shot that's on the poster.
Yeah, exactly. That sets up the blank slate. So then you go on and he's watching Dragon Ball Z on the TV, and he's got his Dragon Ball Z sheets, and you know, mom's got a boyfriend that comes over, and you can tell there's tension right away, and then later on you can hear them yelling at each other, and he sees all this happening, and that's the spark. So that's the genesis of at least what we see first hand of his mother going through this process that she goes through over and over and over again through the film. And the father
sister busts out some Britney Spears, "Hit Me Baby One More Time."
Yeah.
That was great.
And the father, at the beginning of the film, looks like you can't really get a grasp on what he is, but you can tell that he hasn't been there. Maybe he's out trying to find himself, trying to be a musician. You know, they say he was in Alaska. We don't know if that's true or not, because there's some wink and a nod type things going on. Throughout the film, it's all about how these four characters grow. And it's not just Mason Jr. It's all four characters. So in the end, you know, mom realizes that she's she's practically been through her life already. She's still got 20, 30 years to go or whatever. But, you know, she's at that point.
50
that midlife,
or 60, thank you.
That midlife crisis stage, right? Where it's kind of like, I've lived my life. Is that all there is? You know?
And, she's also having that empty nester thing that, my last child has just graduated high school. What do I do with myself? Because she's always identified as a mom.
Right.
And while she's still a mom, she's not going to have that day-to-day mothering.
Right. She hasn't. No longer does anyone depend upon her to do, you know, anything. So, the father turns out to be someone who is actually a very good person, who just kind of needed the right person to settle him down, not argue with him all the time, but also not let him get away with crap all the time.
Yeah, so he ends up remarried and has another kiddo and
right exactly he's got this little
settles
mug,
into
creepy
his
mustache
life.
Going
yeah,
on
a little bit
I like that mustache, it was funny. You know, and Samantha is off to college and she's very calm, she's very I guess at peace with what's become her life now, going to college,
yeah,
having a boyfriend she likes. And And then there's Mason Jr. who doesn't know. You know, he doesn't know what he's going to do. He doesn't know what he wants to do. But what he does know is that he's now going to get the opportunity to do it on his own.
And to figure himself out.
Right, without anybody pushing him to do something a certain way. So throughout the film, like for example with his photography, he gets interested in photography and he has a class and there's a scene in the film where his teacher is in the dark room with him and he's, you know, he's not mean to him, but he's kind of laying into him about who are you going to become? Are you going to take this talent that you have, which you do have talent, are you going to take that and actually do something with it? And then you realize what does it matter if he does something with it?
Mm-hmm.
If he creates his art, his photography, and he enjoys it, and he looks at it and he gets something from it and he shares it with whoever he wants to and they get something from it, he gets something from that. Why does it matter that he has to make a lot of money off of it? Or why does it matter that he has to be a big name or very famous and stuff like that? And that's the whole premise of the film throughout. You just don't get it until the last little bit is there's so many people. Money doesn't buy you happiness. We saw earlier in the film that money, they had money, the worst situation they were in.
Right.
And, you know, so it's not dependent on money. It's dependent on you in what you like to do. And if you are pleasing yourself, there's really no other reason why you shouldn't be dissatisfied with your life. So, then there's also, you know, there's a big message about alcohol in the film, but it doesn't get to the point of preachiness.
Exactly. I never felt that way.
Because, I mean, he goes through and sees all these alcoholics throughout his life and the negative effect they have on him. And when you get to the point of him starting to drink alcohol, he does, but it never turns into anything one way or another. Mm-hmm. He doesn't turn into a raging alcoholic. And he doesn't, like, completely say, you know, I don't want to touch this stuff either. He's his own man. He tries it. Because throughout the film, the lessons he's learned is that people are going to get you to try to do stuff. But it's up to you to figure out what you're going to do because you're your own person. Because if they go away and you do all this stuff for them, and all of a sudden they're gone, what are you? You know, you're not yourself. You're someone else for them. And then it's like, oh. But I really enjoyed the relationship between Ethan Hawke, his character, and the son. Because while it was distant in a way, it was almost like it was distant
better.
For his safety. Like, I'm not the father you need right now. Not like he was getting the father he needed anyway with the stepfathers, but at the same time, Ethan Hawke's character didn't really know that.
Right.
You know, he wanted him to have a house and, you know, whatever he needed for school, and he wanted to just have fun with them. Then he realized once he got his own family,
yeah, it's a little bit more. And, you know, there is a conversation that they have where he, you know, pretty much apologizes for not having, not that he wasn't there, but not having for been there, for having been there at the degree or level that, you know, maybe he was needed.
Right.
And, you know, like, that was actually kind of refreshing to see, because how many films do we see, or how many situations in life do we see where, you know, the parent royally screwed something up, but they never own up to it. So right. It was nice to see that in this situation, he admitted, I wasn't the best dad, and I'm so sorry for that, and I'm going to work on it, and I'm going to make sure that I'm better from here forward, not only for you guys, but, you know, for my other child right. that I have now and have to start over with raising. And I really liked that they kind of helped with setting the stage and the timeline and everything using yeah. some, like, pop culture stuff.
Yeah.
Like, in the beginning, like I said, you know, Samantha busts out a really horrid version of the Britney Spears song.
Even though that was, I mean, that was a couple years before.
Right, but, you know, like, okay, I totally know when that song was popular.
Well, what they do is, instead of, like, a score, really, they put music from that era. Yeah,
from that year.
Yeah.
That,
so it starts out with Coldplay and transitions mm-hmm. into, you know, other stuff that I'm sure I didn't recognize who the band was or whatever. But
I liked that because, you know, it just really helped with kind of placing the time. And, you know, they did make some other references to things like an upcoming election and mm-hmm. The 9/11 attacks was briefly mentioned.
Yeah.
But, you know, the great thing about it, too, is that nothing is, like, overtly the focus. Like, oh my gosh, we must now sit down and discuss these terrorist attacks on 9/11.
Right.
Like, it's not like that's what it is. It's just, like, mentioned in passing so you're aware that, okay, this is where we're at in our timeline.
Right.
I just, it's so difficult to even think of, like, the words to describe, for me, like, how amazing this movie was. I mean, you pretty much summed up, like, the, you know, plot and situation and everything, but it's just brilliant, amazing, a genius film.
You need to really watch it with the understanding that this is not a movie for entertainment value. This
right.
is a movie, and I was entertained by it. Don't yeah. get me wrong, yeah. but it's not out to entertain you. That's not its goal. It's not out to be a comedy, you know, more so a melodrama or whatever. I guess if you had to characterize it as something, but in all honesty, it was funny. You know, when they're talking about the stuff, when they're actually putting out the signs for Obama, and, you know, the lady's saying, I made shirts for my daughter, or what was it, something about my mama or something?
My
Obama.
Mama's for Obama, yeah, my or mama's something for like Obama. That.
And she's just going on. And Samantha or Mason that's up there? One of the two.
I think it's Samantha because Mason's
yeah.
putting the
yeah,
sign
Samantha's
everywhere.
Up there. And she's at this teen age where she's kind of awkward. She's got braces and stuff like that. She's just mm-hmm. standing there smiling. She's got this smile plastered on her face like, she's weirding me out, okay. And then they go back down and their dad, you know, pulls up and says, all right, did you get all the signs? Okay, you got two left? Good. Go steal that McCain sign over there. You know, it's just little small things like that. It's getting over their personality. And I've said it before on the show, I like subtle humor. And that it's full of subtle humor. And even to the point where he strings you along. It's like funny, sad, high tension moment, funny, and then it's awkward, you know, mm-hmm. and he just kind of strings you along with this, and so
and
you're
feel
feeling
like
all
you
these different
get
emotions.
That also, like, during the awkward teen years, it actually shows the awkwardness, the teen years, conversations with girls, or the
with the whole discussion in the bowling alley with the dad and Samantha talking about
boyfriends and condoms protections, and prophylactics, her reaction was, I think, spot on to
it was great.
Any 14, 15 year old girl's reaction would be when their dad has a sex conversation with
them.
That
was real, instead of like, dad, you know, how an actor would do it.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the little things about the film that just makes it feel authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention all of the stuff, because they shot it in order, there's no continuity errors, really. There's a few. I mean, I think there was one where they said this came out this year and it didn't, but you know, it's not a huge deal. But visually, you see, Halo being played in this year. Makes sense, because they shot it, so that's what was big in that year. Right. The Wii being played in 2006, because it was big then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that was kind of a great way to do things in that sense, too. It's just making things feel authentic. Now, if you are probably over 30 or something, you may not connect with it as much as people under 30 would, because it is about the early 2000s all the way up until now.
And I think that the people children. That this is really gonna like affect even more so than us who are in our mid to late 20s are those who are, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, maybe 21, because this is filmed up through, you know, him turning 18, and I think the actor is 19 or 20.
He's 18, I think.
Is he 18?
He was 18 when they stopped filming, yeah.
Okay, so I don't know how long it took to edit and put it all together, but
edited as they went.
But I mean, like, to add that final piece and get it fully done or whatever. But, so I think that those that literally were the ages of this character are gonna really, I mean, yes, we've all been 6, 7, 8, that's not what I mean, but to be 18, 19, 20 right now and know that when it's showing him at age 6, I was age 6. What was I doing at age 6? Was I watching that? Was I singing that song? Yeah. Was I playing this game? And it, you know, you literally watch them grow up before your eyes. You feel like you're, you know, growing up with them, or you can remember what you were doing at that age when that song was big, when that game was big, when that movie was out.
And not only that, but it also, like, what was I doing in 2002 when they started filming this? And, you know, trying to match up your life with what was going on in the film at that time.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, when they're doing the signs for, you know, the election, I was thinking, like, I was pregnant with my son when, you know, the election happened.
And we had no clue they were doing any of this.
Yeah, and it's just, like, amazing that they've been doing this for so long and that they kept it, you know, essentially kept it quiet.
Yeah.
For so long. And another thing I wanted to mention is that even though they started filming so long ago, not that that was really that long, but I love that it doesn't look like, if I didn't know better, I would think that they just shot it all at once, because there's not an issue with the film itself. Not like
it's very disjointed, but so is life.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't...
But, I mean, it's not like in the beginning scenes you have, like, really grainy stuff or whatever. And then at the end,
visually,
it's, like, perfect.
Visually, it's
You know,
fine.
So it's really great that they did that. But I agree, you know, this is basically a snapshot of life, which is imperfect, and it is awkward, and it is angry, and it is happy, and it is funny, and it is sad, and it is confusing. And I feel like this does an amazing job of actually capturing that. Right. And yeah, I mean, it,
I really don't think there's going to be
with it. It's just so amazing.
I really don't think there's going to be another film that passes it this year. I don't see what could. I don't see any film saying anything better than what this said. You know, there could be maybe better made films from a technical standpoint.
But this isn't trying to be all of those things.
I think it's like that. It's like a food dish. It's like you can have the most technically perfect thing, but if someone over here makes this dish, maybe not perfect, but it tastes incredible because they added that one special secret seasoning or whatever they did to it, then it elevates it beyond that. Again, this is like, this film is hovering above every other film right now. It's just, it did something that no other film so far has been able to do. And while there have been very entertaining films so far this year, I've given a number of good reviews out and all seemingly clumped together, too. When you compare it with this, it's just, it's child's play for the other films, you know? It's like, what do you do? What did you do with the, you know, you set out to make this film, and okay, you made this film, but it's like getting schooled by the master.
Right.
You kind of look at your film and say, oh, we didn't really do all that much special there. Even though that shouldn't be the way it is, it's just how it is. When somebody does something so incredible that surpasses anything done in the last 5-10 years, you know, what are you going to do except give it its props?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how this could not win Best Picture at the Oscars this year. I don't understand how it couldn't.
At minimum.
Best Picture, Best Director, at least. So, and then there's also one thing I want to talk about, and then we'll move on to our next review, because we're spending a lot of time on this one.
But it deserves it.
Yeah, it does deserve its time. But also, there's a song at the end, and there's a song that plays in the trailers. And it's a catchy song and everything like that, but the song, actually, if you listen to the lyrics, it matches up perfectly with this movie. It's also talking about, don't make me out to be your hero. I just want to be like everyone else. I want my chance to just walk amongst everybody else and figure out life, and don't push this upon me, and, you know, let me just live life with my family, you know, and maybe we only get by, but at least let me take my wife out for dinner every once in a while and have a good weekend or have a fun weekend or whatever. That's life. That's truly life. And so many other films miss it because they go for something so grand, you know, that's not realistic, which it might be nice or something. You may think, oh, that's nice that it ended that way. That's very happy and everything like that. That's not the way it goes. Because even if something happy happens right now to us, there's time after that. Something bad is probably going to happen. Maybe not right after that, but a few days, a few weeks, a few months, whatever. It doesn't end right there. And this feeling, this song and this movie expresses that life doesn't end. Unless you're dead, of course.
But even then, if you die,
right, life still goes on. Yeah. But your life is the theme of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though it ended kind of, you know, without any big hurrah or anything like that, who says it's over?
Mm-hmm.
Who says they're not going to make another one with 12 years of footage?
Right.
You know, that's the thing. It's like, even if they don't, I mean, life isn't over yet. So that's that. But that's my review.
But
your
I do
review.
Have to ask you one question before we wrap up on this film. You have given this a 5 out of 5, which is your highest rating since we've started these reviews. In your overall films that you've ever seen in your life, would you say that this is the greatest film you've ever seen? Or is there another one that you would put above it or at the same level as? Because I know that this is in a category all its own, but
I think if you're talking about pure message, and if you're excluding documentaries, then I would say probably, yeah. Because I think it's to me, it's the most important message. You know, it's because so many kids are pressured into doing stuff. And it's not just by parents, but by teachers and stuff. Yeah, they want them to do their best and want them to have opportunities and so on and so forth. But most of the time, they're trying to push their failures out onto these kids. I didn't live up to my dreams and goals, but you can.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know what their dreams and goals are, so you're just talking out your ass. You know, you don't spend the time to sit down and ask these kids, what's your dream? What's your goal? What do you want to do? And I feel that this film should be shown to young people, and even though there isn't, even though there's a lot of swirly content in there, you know, there's drugs and alcohol use by minors, there's some language, there's some intense moments of not so much violence. You don't really see any violence, but insinuated violence, suggested
also
violence.
Abuse.
Abuse. You know, so, but I think kids should see this because so many kids are in their bubble. You know what I mean? So the kids that are living lives like this need to see this to say, I'm not the only one that's going through this. And kids that aren't need to see it because there's stuff like this that goes on. You should be grateful for everything that you do have. And grateful that your parents don't smack each other around, yell at each other, curse, drink, whatever. You know, it's such an important film that, again, it goes beyond just film and whatever else we watch, you know. And with that, on that note, we go to Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Which, by the way, I was talking to you about it, and I said it's going to be really hard to go in and watch these other films. And I think maybe affected the film we'll talk about after Sin City. We'd like to thank you for listening to the Lex Podcast, but don't forget you can check us out on Facebook and Instagram at facebook.com/marriedreviews and instagram.com/marriedreviews. Also, if you'd like to get a hold of us, have a comment, question, or anything else, you can at lexmarston@gmail.com. That's LEXMARSTON@gmail.com. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Another big screen offering from Robert Rodriguez, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, continues the stories from the Sin City comics, focusing on two pulled from the graphic novels and adding two more. Returning cast members Mickey Rourke, Jessica Alba, Powers Booth, Bruce Willis, Jamie King, Rosario Dawson are joined by some newcomers to the film, Jamie Chung, Josh Brolin, Ava Green, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and more. The visuals in this film are amazing, with the black and white added splashes of color, but the confusing stories when compared to the first film and the overacting means that this could have been executed a bit better. Still, I give it a 3.5 out of 5, mostly on the visuals, because it is really cool to take stuff from page to screen when you've got the graphic novels, and just the way that they do it with the mostly black and white and then adding the pops of color, I think really brings something a little extra.
I think it's especially difficult to bring it from page to screen. It's not an easy thing to do.
I so want to see, like, behind the scenes making of something, just because.
Right. Well, you're going to see a lot of green screen.
But I mean, like, some of these, you know.
It's not easy to do. It's very tedious stuff
to
do.
And I know that a lot of it is done. You know, you can only film so much and then you add things in post-production, all that. But, like, that's what I want to see. Like, how much really goes into creating this?
Right.
Because some of
these
things
are. We now have the technology to bring those things
right.
to life.
So, in that sense, it's, like, really amazing. The thing that causes confusion and seems to be a lot of viewers of this film's issue, as I've discovered on the IMDb message boards, is that none of it makes sense because of continuity. Evidently, three of these four little stories are supposed to be prequels to Sin City. But it's just confusing because it doesn't really explain that.
I get that.
It makes it hard because due to some unfortunate things that happened between filming the first and the second, different actors are having to play characters, so it, you know, kind of
honestly,
throws things off
for
and
me,
that sort of thing.
It had been so long since I saw Sin City, since 2006 or whatever, I didn't care. Like, I was ready to just kind of wipe that whole thing. In fact, I wasn't a huge fan of the first Sin City film. I enjoyed the Yellow Bastard storyline, just because it's weird and it's cool.
Definitely comic-y.
It's cool. You know, a guy gets his junk shot off, and he comes back as this deranged, you know, even more deranged than he already was, you know. But this, I think, to me, even though it was kind of jumbled around, the stories were, and even though people say, well, it was a prequel to this and whatever, I feel like it was more concentrated than the first film was. Because we got two, I mean, there may have been four stories or whatever, but we got two main stories.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that those are the two that were pulled from the right. graphic novels.
Well, A Dame to Kill For, which was from the graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then one that was, or it was the other way around or something like that, where one was written but never published.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and so then we get the other one of Nancy trying to take down, what's his
Senator Rourke,
Senator
played
Rourke.
By Powers Booth.
Right. Senator Rourke. And so the whole Joseph Gordon-Levitt storyline took up quite a bit of film. You know, it was, I mean, there was a lot of time spent on that story, but at the same time, I didn't feel like it was one of the deeper stories. It was a cool story because he comes in here, you know, winning all this stuff. He puts a quarter in the slot machine, wins, skips the middle one, goes to the end, puts a quarter in, wins all this, then takes all that and goes into the poker game
mm-hmm.
with Senator Rourke and the police officer and the, you know, other lackeys.
Basically, it's a shady backroom card
right.
game.
Right. Nobody goes back there unless they want to die pretty much.
Yeah, because if
or lose
you
their
happen
money.
To beat him, you will not live to tell
right,
about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. But the cool thing was, what they did, the swerves they did, and I don't want to give it all away or whatever, but the swerves they did with this were cool. They were enough to keep me hanging on, and they were a break from the A Dame to Kill For storyline. And the other main story with Nancy trying to kill Senator Rourke was something that didn't need a whole lot of time spent on it. But you know it had to be the ending thing. It had to be the final thing. Because, obviously, if she succeeds, she's going to kill him. If she fails, she's going to be killed. So, you know.
Yeah.
But I visually, too, because with the Joseph Gordon-Levitt storyline, we get to see a lot of Powers Booth, who is phenomenal in this film as a real jackass.
Yeah, he's freaking creepy.
He plays a really, really good bad guy. And so we get a lot of dialogue between the two. There's also a moment where it does this metaphorical thing where Gordon-Levitt's standing on the table, but he's like a little... like a miniature guy,
mm-hmm.
and Powers Booth throws his cards at him and slices
literally
them
chops
up.
Them.
Yeah, because that was symbolic of what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though you win, you're not going to walk out of this alive. And so that bit was cool, but I can understand people saying, "Well, it really didn't have much to do with anything,"
mm-hmm.
and it didn't. Right? It was just kind of. But you get that in comics. You know, we haven't read a lot of comics, but you get those side stories that
mm-hmm.
don't have the huge payoff, but they were a lot of fun to read because
yeah.
of how they were written, how they were drawn, too.
Because that's the big thing with graphic novels is, I mean, yeah, you want to get something out of the dialogue or the plot or story, but the majority of it is in the artwork, the drawings, the, you know... picture that you're looking at, because that helps bring the words to life.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have that, I think, as a good base when you're doing a graphic novel.
Right. It's good to get the gritty comic book movie every once in a while. Because we got Guardians of the Galaxy, which is great. We've gotten Batman. We've gotten Spider-Man, X-Men. X-Men's a little gritty, but nothing like Sin City. So... it's fun to kind of, it's like doing the things you're not supposed to do is sometimes the most fun. You know, viewing these comic book movies that are bloody,
but even
a lot
then,
of nudity. And
the bloody violent scenes, it's comic book bloody, so you see the black and white silhouette. So right. The slice of the sword, but it's white splattering.
Yeah. But at you the same see... time, you know, decapitations and stuff like
well,
that.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's not gory. It's not overly saturated in, you know, red liquid. Like, I don't know that the color red is ever actually shown for the blood. I mean, yes, we see the color red. We see the color blue, green, a little bit of pink. Did I say blue already? I don't know. Green in her eyes.
Right.
But the red that we do see is never blood. Right. The blood is always shown as that white across the black.
So, okay, so the main story of Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, is the A Dame to Kill For part.
What?
Where Josh Brolin, playing Dwight, basically is summoned by Eva, played by...
The character's name is Ava, and she's played by Ava Green.
Okay, there you go.
Who I think pulls off the beautiful but sinister psychopath quite well.
Yeah, she's got crazy in her eyes, that's for sure. And she does not like to wear clothes, apparently.
No, and you know the funny thing? Everything I've ever seen her in, it's like, that's... She has no issues with nudity.
Well, she is topless more than she's...
Clothed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Topped. definitely a lot of boob time for her. And she... They do this thing with her when she is manipulating men... Her eyes turn green, and so it's a cool little effect. But she does a lot of manipulating in the film, and
then eventually her eyes stay green.
That's where the twists and turns come from. You know, she's straight up evil succubus type style. Chris Maloney gets a small part in the film as a detective who gets basically entranced by her. Doesn't end up meaning a whole lot. Yeah, doesn't end up meaning a whole lot in the film, but he does a good job.
But it also helps to show kind of the allure and the power that she holds.
Right, exactly. And the only person that's really not, who doesn't succumb to her power is the mayor. I believe it's the mayor.
I don't know if he was the mayor or if he was just the owner of.
Oh yeah, he might have just been. I can't remember. I'm terrible.
But played by Stacey Keach.
Yeah.
Can't remember offhand what the character's name is, so you're looking that up. But he was funky looking, just like the character of Marv is not. You know.
Yeah.
Normal looking, right. Or, you know, after being shot in. The unfortunate places, the yellow bastard, and the way that he became. Like, you know, there are non-human characters
in Wallenquist. This. That's his name. Wallenquist.
Wallenquist. Okay. So, Stacey Keach plays that character, though.
Yeah. He has a lot of power in town, basically.
Yeah.
Because they talk about, you know, what's the other part of town called? Old Town?
Yeah, which is where... Basically, the women run Old Town.
Yeah, the prostitutes run Old Town. So that doesn't make much sense because...
Why not?
Well, they're running the town, yet they go do things for money in the meantime.
People come to them.
Yeah, I know, but it's just... It doesn't that sound weird? Like if the president or the mayor of town went and did services for people... Doesn't that seem weird to you?
No.
I guess it's weird to me, I guess. But I guess it's weird that they're so violent and so, like, bloodthirsty, yet they're doing this thing that where they have to succumb to someone else for money. Okay. Anyway, we'll move on from that. But yeah, it's visually pleasing. It's a fun time at the movies. I gave it a 4 out of 5, a notch higher than you did, which I didn't think was going to happen. I thought you would give it the higher rating than I would because you're more inclined.
I was surprised as well.
Be entertained by this, but I really didn't find much wrong with it. You know, it's not going to blow you out of the water with its writing or you know, I mean, sure, these are stories you've even heard before, I'm sure. But that's not the point with comic books, you know? Do you know how many times they reboot superheroes and tell the same story?
I know, I'm still annoyed by the fact that there have been multiple Spider-Man in, you know, recent years, and like how many people have played Superman and how many people have played Batman, and
yeah, just over and over and over again. So. It's the style, it's the visuals, it's, you know, it's putting everything together. It's the choreographed fight scenes with the chick with the samurai sword doing some cool helicopter stuff.
Which, with that, I didn't even make the connection until I was reading trivia, but that character of Miho was played by somebody different in this film than the first one, because the actress who played that character in the first film was pregnant with her child during filming of this one, so couldn't, so they... But, like, that went over my head.
So what you're saying is they all look the same.
I did not say that.
I'm just kidding.
I'm saying it's been so long since I've seen the first film that some of those more minor characters, especially the ones that don't speak...
Right.
I didn't even, like, realize that it wasn't the same person just because it's been so long.
You weren't the only one, so don't worry about it.
Call me a racist.
Yeah, but I recommend it, especially if you like the first film. I think this is better than the first film. I think if you like the first film, there's, again, just like with Dolphin Tale 2, you like the first one, there's no reason why you wouldn't like this one. It's more of the same, and I think it's better, more concentrated, and overall the acting was better too. I like the acting much better. And we haven't even talked about Marv yet, because Marv was the comic relief in the whole thing.
And because his character was so out of place in this film at all.
But he's so cool, though. He's exactly what you want him to be. He's the guy who gets used for things. Like, someone's in trouble, let's go call Marv. And sure enough, what's it take to get Marv involved? A few drinks, maybe an exaggerated story or something like that, and he's ready to go kill some people.
Yeah.
That's Marv. That's cool. That's perfect, you know? So he wasn't, like, the main plot of something. He's a weirdo. He's a freak, and he's fueled on... He's got strong emotional ties, and he's fueled on those emotional ties to Nancy, to, you know, women in general or whatever. So, and also Dennis Haysbert as Manute was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying in terms of the unfortunate things, is that he was played by Michael Clark Duncan in the first film, and he has since passed, so they had to, you know, use somebody else. And this is meant to be a prequel to what we see in the first film.
Right.
So, you know, with what happens to the character, you know, I could see how they could, you know, in terms of continuity things, could explain the change. And Josh Brolin plays Dwight in this film and is played by Clive Owen in the other film, but it's because it's mentioned that he's had surgery and has a new face. So, you
Which,
know, like,
by the way, it's funny because later on in the film, he gets surgery, like a lot of work done, and he steps off the train, and he looked like Harrison Ford to me.
Yeah, I was trying to place who that actor was, not realizing
like, did
that it was
Harrison
supposed
Ford
to be the
and
same
just
character
drop him in there?
That's... or whatever.
But no.
I read that they did want Clive Owen to come and play that last little bit. That way it helps with the continuity into, you know, the other film.
Mm-hmm.
But that he wasn't available, so they just did the prosthetics.
Yeah, it's whatever.
But
it's
I didn't
whatever.
Even realize until more at the end there that it was even the same person. And she even comments, it's in the eyes. And then it like shows his full face. And then, yeah,
it took
you can
a few camera angles for me, but I could tell it was him. He looked like a very much... It looked very much like a younger Josh Brolin. So, and now for what is my pick for worst film of 2014 thus far, The Identical, a film not really about Elvis Presley, but a film that's about Elvis Presley. Identical twins are separated at birth, one kept by the biological parents, and the other given to a preacher and his wife who have been told they can't conceive on their own. One of the twins grows up to be a big-time star, and the other grows up impersonating his brother, oblivious to their relation. The premise of The Identical sounds all right, but it's not. It's stuck halfway between reality and fiction and plummets into 2 hours of forced emotion and cheesy acting. The score is terrible. The acting is bad. The music performed is forgettable. The Identical looks bad on the surface just by viewing the trailer, but it's much worse than that. I don't know how the Presley Estate doesn't have the grounds to sue the makers of this film. If they don't, everyone who paid to see it should get band together and sue. I give The Identical a 1.5 out of 5. Lowest rating so far this year, and a film that I didn't necessarily think I would be giving my lowest rating to going into it. But it just does not make any sense.
And it just doesn't work.
It's like we've got a full film made out of somebody's living room conversation about, hey, you know what would be cool? If someone made a movie about the conspiracy of Elvis having a twin that's still alive. And then they couldn't get the rights to Elvis Presley. And so they just said, screw it. We'll just get this lookalike and we'll call it something else.
Well, the thing that was hard for me is, and I mentioned this to you after I had seen it, but before you had, that it was hard for me to, like, wrap my mind around the fact that this is not supposed to be Elvis because he looks so much like him. The singing, the voice is so
everything.
Much like him. The dancing is so
the
much like
it. The timeline, the places.
That it was just very, very distracting and right. hard for me to separate in my mind that he's not supposed to be Elvis.
Everything was knockoff city in this.
But this person, the actor who played this role, has been working as an Elvis impersonator for most of his life.
Dead ringer for Elvis.
Yeah, like, that's why it was so hard for me, because I'm like, I'm looking at Elvis.
Exactly.
That.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
It's not like they had twins and said, well, these guys are twins. Oh, they just happen to look like Elvis. No, same guy plays both twins. Mm-hmm. So it's like they tried to do this marketing ploy and tried to get away with it. And it's so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
The premise is beyond dumb, and I get hung up on the premise.
I
can't even go any
further.
And I feel
like they could have done something with the idea of twins separated at birth.
If they came up with their own goddamn
one
story.
One goes on to do something that becomes famous, and the other one, you know, is interested in the same thing,
right?
But doesn't make it, you know, whatever. Like, I could see that, but the thing that, like, was so difficult about this is, so there ends up being this contest to
Sing Like the Dream.
Yeah, which, I'm sorry, what kind of a freaking name is Drexel? Drexel Hensley.
I don't know.
So, whatever. But he's big and popular and famous, and then
we don't get to see his rise to fame at all.
No, it's
Everything is from the standpoint of the viewpoint of the Identical brother. So,
whose name is Ryan.
Ryan.
And Ryan likes singing. He enjoys it. The big thing that kind of starts everything is that there's a Sing Like the Dream contest that
and this is an hour to an hour and a half into the film.
Yeah. That he enters into and is singing, and then the real thing comes and listens to some of it and, like, basically is like, yep, he's the winner, and then leaves, and some other guy after the show comes up and, here's my card, come talk to me Monday, you are the closest thing to the real thing
right.
in terms of looks and sound. And it's like, yes, people comment throughout, like, you look just like him. But it's like, how has nobody, like, ever made the connection, or how has he not looked at that and been like, Mom, Dad, we have to talk. How is it that I look exactly like this guy? How is it that I sound exactly like him? Right. And how is it that nobody else seems to realize that you're not just a good impersonator, but you sound just as good? Like, I think part of my issue was there's no reason why he wasn't at the same level as or above in terms of fame and popularity. It's just there's so many things that don't work.
Yeah, it's
my
a lazy
biggest,
film.
biggest issue, which I have said before. I mentioned it with the actor who played Frankie Valli, that it's frustrating to me when you have in Jersey Boys, when you have somebody playing well outside their age. I feel like this guy, he looked younger, you know, in Jersey Boys. He looked young enough to be able to somewhat convincingly be teenager, adult, whatever. This movie, this guy is in his 40s. And at the, you know...
There's a kid that plays him at, like, 9 years old or something like that.
Which is great. But then if you're going to do that, if you're going to show him over the course of different stages of life, why not use somebody who's actually, like, in their early to mid-20s to play him at the age of 18 or so? Don't have a 40-year-old playing an 18-year-old, because that is freaking ridiculous. And it was not believable. And it just, like, took, like, I was completely out of it.
Well, I agree with you. In the sense of, yeah, he looked older.
Oh, don't disagree with me now.
I am going to disagree with you, because I actually tried to suspend my disbelief quite a few times in this film to try to make it work. And that's one of the things I was like, okay, I've seen teenagers that age look that big, look that old. And let's also remember that we're comparing him to Ray Liotta. So when Ray Liotta's chewing him out for being out so late, Ray Liotta is this tall, and Ryan is much taller than him, so he's looking up and yelling at him the whole time. And it's funny, because what's he going to do? You know, Ryan is taller than him. But I have seen teenagers. My cousin, James, was that big and looked old.
But James did not look like a 40-year-old at the age of 18.
I don't necessarily...
He still doesn't look anywhere near...
I don't necessarily think he looked like a 40-year-old. I think that's probably what Elvis looked like when he was that age.
Look at pictures of Elvis at the age of 18 versus...
If I can find them.
His age at the time of his death, and you will see that, yeah, there's similarities.
Well, at the time of his death, okay. If there's anything that's wrong with it, is that he didn't age... enough. Like, his face stayed the same, right? So I don't have a problem with him early on, but they didn't show really any wear except for a very bad prosthetic beard that he had.
Yeah, that's horrible.
So that didn't
but
bother
like,
me.
Just, I guess my biggest thing is, like, because him at the age of, you know, 18 to 25 is such a brief time, like, why didn't they use someone else for that little bit? And then, like, okay, now I'm in my 30s, and now I'm in my 40s, because that's believable when you've got a 40-year-old playing, you know, different ages. And admittedly, there are people out there who are in, like, their mid to late 30s that still look like teenagers, and yes, are still playing them on TV, but it's believable because of how they look. And also, the woman who played the biological mother, the birth mother, Helen, that actress looked just the same on her deathbed when she's an old woman as she did
well, she wasn't
the day
really
she gave birth.
An old woman, though. Like, she was
but
only...
But it's supposed to imply that, like, 30 years have gone by. I don't see that. I didn't...
No, not that many.
From
well,
the...
okay.
Assuming that he...
Because he had just gotten out of the army not that long ago.
Right, so assuming that he went into the army at about age 20... And
well, he went into the army about the time that he got busted at the thing.
So, 18, 19, 20.
So
somewhere right in there, assuming he spent, you know, 5 years in.
She could have, I mean, at most, she was probably 40.
But that's what I'm saying, is if she was in her 20s when she gave birth, it's been at least 25 years.
Right,
she did not look like she was in her 50s or older.
45. 50.
She looked like she was...
She was also very ill, so it was hard to tell. So.
The only thing that they had was she had, like, shadows under her eyes. In no other way did she look sick or frail.
She looked pale and yellow to me. Like, anyway, my big exception with all this is Ray Liotta and how quickly he aged.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like, obviously, they had no issue aging.
Everybody was kind of... That is one thing I'll agree with. Everybody was off. Like, no, they didn't... And it was funny, I actually listened to a review that said it was like everybody had their own vortex. Everybody was aging at different periods of time.
That's good.
And so, you know, that's one of the flaws. Let's talk about the terrible music that's played in the film.
Again, because all I hear, Elvis's voice.
It's Elvis's voice, but singing lower grade songs.
Something.
It's like, you know, it's like songs Elvis rejected type stuff, you know. Yeah. It's none of it's memorable and none of it's catchy. They don't use real songs.
The only reason I remembered that is because we watched the trailer before we started recording.
I remembered it, I guess, because they did it a few times in the movie. Like, they did it 3 or 4 different times. So, you know, when they pound it in your head that much, that's fine. Very odd that they got Seth Green cast in this. Very odd that they got Ray Liotta or Ashley Judd cast in this. I don't know. Listen, the film is made by a Christian-based company. So
no, really,
it's got, well, actually, you know what, the stuff in the film wasn't too preachy. Like,
it was, though.
They, well, it
it's
was
in your face, it's shouting at you.
But at the same literally. Time, Ryan is going against that. In a true, like, Christian film, Ryan wouldn't be going against it that much. Or he would, at the end, become a preacher or something.
But he really isn't going against it. It's not until literally, like, right at the end that his dad, like, even will admit to the fact that, like, okay, I can see you do your own thing.
I don't think it was that bad.
I do.
I don't think it was that bad. But maybe they felt... I know Seth Green is Jewish, so obviously he didn't get a role because he was sympathetic to the cause, if you will. And maybe Ray Liotta and Ashley Judd are. I'm pretty sure Ashley Judd is, at least.
And can I just say how weird it was that of these four films, we saw Ashley Judd in Dolphin Tale and The Identical. Yes. We saw Ray Liotta in this and in Sin City.
Which, his performance in Sin City was very entertaining, by the way.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's just, like, a weird crossover with these movies we saw this week.
Yeah, there was. So, Ashley Judd looked awful in this movie.
And I'm wanting to say that there was another person that was in this and one of the other ones, but now I've lost it. But, it was just weird. But, and that's what I'm saying about, like, the aging that they did was only on the men. Like, they didn't bother trying to age the women, really, because... Helen, on her deathbed, did not look that old. And then the end of the film, like, Ray Liotta's character is like, you know, he's got more wrinkles and the,
he
know,
looks like
thinning white
he
hair.
Looks like two things I'm going to mention. One, for more modern folks, he looks like Johnny Knoxville as Bad Grandpa.
Yes.
For people who go a little bit further back, he looks like Dan Aykroyd in the film Nothing But Trouble.
Yeah.
The judge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, he's got that loose, slick back white hair and, you know.
But it's like with Ashley Judd, they didn't really try to age her. I mean, she's got a little bit of wrinkles and everything, but like.
More meat on the face a little bit.
Nothing with the hair to indicate.
Basically.
Like, it was just.
It was bad.
Everybody had their own time vortex. That's pretty much it.
And then we talk about more bad makeup later in the film. Drexel, that's his name, Drexel. Mm-hmm. And Ryan, instead of looking like Elvis, started to look like Slash from Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was like some weird thing with that, because he's got the shoulder-length wavy hair. He's wearing like all these layers of scarves and, you know, wearing this
hat. Which I don't recall Elvis
and, like,
doing
sunglasses.
That. Yeah. I don't recall Elvis doing that at all, but and it's funny because these guys obviously look like Elvis. They sing like Elvis. There's some events in their life the same as Elvis. Yet, one of them is as popular as Elvis. Yet they refer to Elvis in this movie. They actually name drop Elvis in this movie. Which, if you're going to do something, don't give us a wink and a nod for a cheap giggle.
But at the same time, I guess I don't really get what you're saying when you say this, because we kind of discussed this earlier. They mention that in the context of, you're not the Beatles, you're not Elvis, you're not any big name.
Drexel, you're Ryan. He's telling Ryan this when Ryan's wanting to write his own songs.
Right.
And perform his own songs.
So I don't really see it as name-dropping Elvis.
Well, it is, though.
It's in there to imply, you are not Elvis. This is not a story about Elvis.
Well, if Elvis exists, Elvis would sue the bastards because they'd take his act. They'd take his same exact act. He looks like him. He's doing surfing movies and everything in the 60s. That's what infuriates me about this film, is it's so stupid.
It is stupid. It's ridiculous.
And yet it takes itself so seriously. There's no way this film is any good at all. And that's the thing. It's like, if you see it, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, because it doesn't look like a bad film, but it's so bad. It's bad from the makeup department. The story sucks. It goes absolutely nowhere. It shoehorns in cheesy emotional stuff, like like heart attacks and stuff like that. And it just pounds you in the head with unoriginality and a premise that doesn't make any sense and doesn't fit. And why not either A, make the Elvis story, or B, make up something completely different and don't use an Elvis impersonator, use a real goddamn actor.
That's what I'm saying, is that had they used someone else, I feel like this could have been different. Somebody that didn't look anything like him, didn't sound anything like him.
It's infuriating. Then,
like, this would have been better if they had taken someone... I can't even think of somebody who would have been better,
I feel bad for this kid, though, this Blake Rain.
Yeah.
Because he seems like a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't be calling him a kid. He's probably twice my age.
He was born in 77. Yeah. He's...
So...
He's old.
Right, exactly.
Not old, but...
I feel bad for him, because this is his first thing he's ever done on film, and it's an absolute pile of trash. And he's partly to blame because he's not a very good actor. It's like Ray Liotta was acting to a wall the whole time.
He was born in 74, excuse me, so he is 40.
Exactly. So, I mean, I feel bad for him because, I mean, he does Elvis, like, nail on the head, right? He looks like Elvis, he talks like Elvis, but he wasn't playing Elvis. I don't get it.
He was a website designer prior to becoming an Elvis entertainer. In 1998, he won an Elvis impersonator competition... And spent the next bit of his life working as an Elvis impersonator.
Well, I could pound my head against the wall all night trying to figure out this premise and what they were going for, but I can't. And I'm going to stop.
Blake said the script sounded like his own life story. Does he have some long-lost twin? How is this about his life story?
Just met the contest. But, yeah, worst film of the year so far for me that I've seen. I'm sure there's a film out there that can top it. I don't know if it's going to be coming our way in our theater. I have that 0 to 1, those ratings reserved for a special type of movie. That direct-to-home video shot on a camcorder that still uses VHS tapes type movie. That's that movie down there. So you may never hear me give a 0 or a 0.5 or a 1. A 0, I don't even know if I'd give a 0, because you'd have to give me an incomplete film to get a 0. But boy, is this film rotten. Don't go see this, folks. Don't be fooled by anything. I don't care if you're Christian, you're Muslim, you're Jewish. Don't go see this film. It is awful. It has no direction at all. First time director, shocker. Overacting from actors I actually liked. It pained me to see Ray Liotta act so awfully,
right?
Because he was trying so goddamn hard to play off this guy who is, you know, good intentions and everything, but dude, you're out of your league. Go back to Vegas and pretend to be Elvis. You can probably make a lot more money and a lot more street cred doing that. So, but yeah, that's enough for this.
So you gave it a 1.5.
Yeah, what did you give it, by the way? I know you said you're going to give it a 2.
Yeah, last night I had a 2 listed with a question mark because I wasn't 100% positive on that.
It's got good cinematography.
Yeah, and you know, like, that's kind of what I'm looking at, is that some of the shots were actually really decent. The angles, the lighting, the colors like of the film were nice and vibrant. You know, the beginning of the film
That's that wolf in sheep's clothing, I was
saying. Yeah, has that, you know, more...
Except for the costume
gray design. And color like that. And then, you know, because it's older time that they're referring to, and then coming into a slightly more modern time.
Right.
Even then, this film, like, only goes, like, up through, like, what, the 70s or something like that.
Yeah.
So, I think for those reasons, I'm going to stay at a 2. And also because I feel like this could have been something more had they had a different cast.
Had they completely wrote a different movie, yes, it could have been something more.
I don't know, though, because I still feel like if they had a different cast...
If they did the Elvis story, I think it would have worked. If they did the Elvis... Just do the Elvis story.
Even...
And do a conspiracy movie. Even with
the parallels to the Elvis thing, like, I feel if they had used a different actor, maybe somebody with blonde hair, blue eyes that doesn't sound like Elvis, like, it could have been something different, because then there wouldn't be so much focus on how it's Elvis without being Elvis.
Right.
Because I don't feel like that's what they intended when making this, but unfortunately that's what they got.
Yeah, exactly. Do you recommend it?
No.
Okay. Okay. So no recommendation, a 2 for you. No recommendation for me, and a 1.5. So what films do we have on the way for the good people?
Well, we had 3 films set, and of the 3, they actually pulled one and substituted another. So we do have Maze Runner, which I've actually been looking forward to. And then we have A Walk Among the Tombstones. And instead of This Is Where I Leave You, they have instead given us The Drop. So we have those 3 things that are... 2 of them have actually started at our theater tonight, but for the most part, they're there tomorrow through the weekend.
Right.
So,
and it doesn't seem like they're going to shoehorn in any other films, like ones that came out earlier that we didn't get a chance to see.
No, and so if they did, it would be just like a last-minute addition. Does make me wonder, though, when we're going to get This Is Where I Leave You, since that's what was planned for this week. But instead, they took it out and added in The Drop. So it makes me wonder if sometime in the next couple of weeks we're going to get This Is Where I Leave You, maybe when there's only 1 or 2 films slated to come out.
But I can't say that I'm crying over losing that one, because the trailer's been annoying the crap out of me.
See, and it actually was something that I was looking forward to seeing, just because it, you know, seems like a pretty okay film.
Right.
So, and with seeing so many trailers and seeing certain trailers repeatedly, like, you know, we had both admitted we couldn't wait for Guardians of the Galaxy to come out just to stop watching the trailers for it. So, while there may be some films like that, this is actually one that I didn't mind watching the trailers, because... You know, it has a good cast of really strong comedy players. So, and you know, it could be one of those films that bombs, where all of the funny parts are shown in the trailer, and then you watch the film and you're like, this blows.
Sure. I do like, what's his name?
Jason Bateman?
Yeah, I was going, the reason I didn't say anything is because I was going to say Patrick Bateman. Which Patrick Bateman is Christian Bale in American Psycho, so I like Jason Bateman.
There we go.
I like him. He's got good timing. So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for sticking with us. Very long episode. 4 reviews in the can. My best and worst films of the year so far. Your best film of the year so far?
This is the second film I've given a 5, but even with that, I still feel like this is probably the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
All right. So thanks for listening in, and next time we will bring at least 3 movies to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Had fun tonight. Hope you had fun listening. And until next week, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening. Just wanted to say thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening.
I realized I was saying thanks for listening too much. I just went full overboard, you know?
I did like the change in inflection, though.
Well, I'm a man of many talents. The Elvis Presley of my generation. Good night, folks.
Good night.